All right, we're going now on with the second chapter of 1 Peter, beginning with verse 11. Now, this is a very informative section of the book in some practical ways about not only our relationship to God, but also our relationship to the government. That's a very important thing. But we'll start in verse 11. Beloved, I exhort you as strangers and aliens to restrain your fleshly desires, which war against the soul, having your way of life good among the Gentiles, in order that in the things in which they have spoken against you as evildoers, seeing your good works may glorify God in the day of visitation. Now, what does all of that mean? After examining it, strangers and aliens. Various translations of those words occur in the Bible, but the difference between them is that the first one, stranger, means a stranger to a household. The second one means a stranger to a country. So that's why we translate it by alien. The first one would be stranger to a particular home. Now, why does he use the expression strangers and aliens? He uses it in reference to the world, and he's saying to these people, inasmuch as you are strangers to this land, don't make yourself at home in the things that belong to this land. In other words, your fleshly desires. Now, that does not mean you can't have any fleshly desires at all. And this does not necessarily mean anything that is really evil. It just means that you should restrain the things that you might get a taste for in the flesh that would draw your heart away from Christ. Now, there's no limit set on it, and it depends on the individual as to just how much earthly interests can block out the Lord, but that's a very private matter. If your relationship to Christ begins to suffer, you begin losing the contact with Him, then perhaps your mind is too much taken up with the things of the earth. Now, this does not, as I say, refer to evil things. It means just all the things that pertain to this world. You have to watch how much you get involved. Now, and I've used the illustration before, which I think might be, again, applicable here. If you were moving to another city, let's say you were going to move to San Francisco, and you have two more weeks left in the Los Angeles area, you'd be very foolish to be spending all your time involved in things which pertain to the Los Angeles area. You're not going to go out and run for president of the garden club in your local neighborhood. You're not going to get yourself involved in school projects of the school that you may be transferring from anyway, that is, your children will be transferring from. You would do well not to let yourself get tied up with the things which pertain to Los Angeles if you're going to move to San Francisco. So he's really saying here that you are not citizens of this country. You're rather citizens of heaven, and you're going to be going there shortly. So just don't get yourself entangled with the things that are here. Obviously, there are certain things, if you were going to move to San Francisco, there are certain things you'd have to occupy yourself with here. You couldn't ignore the traffic signals, for example, just because you're going to move to San Francisco. But you might ignore the door-to-door canvasser who wants to sell you the newspaper for that city. You see, there's some things you can ignore and some you can't. So in this world, you've got to earn a living, make your way in the world. There are a lot of things you have to do to keep going in this life, even if you are going to be going to another world. All right, but he says these things war against the soul. It's a constant battle, of course. And you develop a taste for things. That's pretty standard psychology, that you can develop a taste for things and you can lose that taste for things. So, for example, here's someone who gets started on the soap operas. And it seems perhaps that the more you get into them, the more you get hooked on them. You can, some women will listen to a stream of soap operas all day long. Now, I don't mean anything bad about listening to soap operas. I just mean that you get a taste for it. It's something you could turn on or turn off. Of course, it's not really a problem, I suppose, unless it's keeping you from your work or unless it's filling your head with ideas that you probably shouldn't have. But a person that might feel, for example, that they were getting too much involved could, they might, by force of will, turn off the television set and decide not to listen to it. Now, I'm saying that these things can get hold of you, and even if they're not necessarily in and of themselves wrong, they could become, they could get a grip on you and become a very important part of your life, perhaps too important. And I'm saying, but while you can develop a taste for them, if you get started into it, you could also, by the same token, lose that taste by just setting yourself not to keep listening. Now, what happens is that if you can hold steady for a few weeks, you lose the trend there. You begin to lose the grip. They lose the grip on you that they have. And then you're all right. This thing comes up as far as general television is concerned. There are parents who wrestle with the problem of whether to let their children watch TV. And many parents have talked to me about the advisability of maybe even getting rid of the television set altogether. Well, the experience of some who've done that, although I haven't made any special recommendation about it, but the people who've done it, quite a number of them who have done it, have indicated that for the first few weeks the children were really very unhappy with the situation, but as time went on they ceased to miss it. And they seemed to get along quite well without it. And that would be very advantageous to people if they could back away from it considerably, because they would get a lot of other things accomplished that they might really enjoy more. For example, they might get into reading. It wouldn't really hurt anybody to read. Might even improve their understanding of things. And now that all of this, I'm laboring it, of course, but I want to make it very indelibly clear to you that what Peter is talking about is the tendency of people to get hooked on things, we may say so. They may not necessarily be evil, but they do war against the soul because they swamp the mind with trivia. Might be a good way to speak of it. There are some things, of course, one is reluctant to recommend the getting rid of television. I found that there was supposed to be a program today outlining the life and works of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was one of the great theologians of Europe that I've read with great interest. And so I got the set going there and was waiting patiently for it, and they had a tennis match. And the tennis kept going and going. So finally I had to abandon the ship and decided they were not going to have Bonhoeffer after all. So unfortunately, what might have been a fairly helpful and educational item was set aside for the rackets. But there are some things that you would miss if you didn't have a television set. Some very good things. It may be that the balance would be such that you would profit more from not having. Now, I'm not laying any rule down. I'm really using that as an illustration of something that can get hold of people. And it might not be that. It could be almost anything. Tennis itself could get hold of a person. And while it's a very wholesome exercise, if a person spent all their time on the courts, they might leave some other things undone. But the flesh is an insatiable entity. I have said to you before that yourself is the hardest taskmaster of all, because the self is never satisfied. No matter how much you have, there's more that you want, you know. And that's true in almost every category of human interest. So the self is an insatiable monster, gobbling up whatever you give it. The more you yield to your selfish interests, the more you become just totally taken up with yourself. And that can be a full-time job, satisfying yourself. But unfortunately, if you assume that full-time job, you also have to take the liabilities with it. The liabilities are that you then become a prisoner of the very thing that you're trying to satisfy. So you become more conscious of your disappointments. The person that is constant, that sets out on a course to primarily satisfy themselves, will find early in the game that they also begin to focus on the ills of their self as well as the good things. There are people who just have one round of problems after another. And sometimes the reason is not that other people don't have problems, but other people have set the problems, their own problems aside while they go out and try to help somebody else. And that's the most wholesome way to go about it. Get your mind off yourself, because the self is a demanding thing, a raucous and ugly duckling. The self can be very ugly if it begins to be raucous and to demand your undivided attention. You become a prisoner then of that self. These are some of the things that sort of circulate around this idea that Peter is getting across. If you focus on your self-interests, your own self, you get into a quicksand here, and you find a battle on your hands of warring against this insatiable creature. Now, he goes on to say, let your manner of living be something that is impressive to the Gentiles. He says, having a good manner of living among the Gentiles, in order that the things in which they speak evil against you, or speak against you as evildoers, beholding your good works, may glorify God in the day of visitation. Now, remember, Peter is speaking to Jews here. And these Jews are what we call the Jews of the dispersion, or the diaspora. This means a lot of the Jews that fled Jerusalem were scattered about the world in little enclaves in various Greek and Roman cities, and in Egypt as well, throughout the Middle East. And these were the ones that Peter was writing to. Now, of course, wherever the Jews went, they became the object of suspicion by the Greeks and the Romans and the Egyptians, and whatever they did was made doubly extreme by the attitude of the people that they were living among. So you see, they were strangers in a very real sense, aliens, foreigners in the communities that they lived in. And therefore, as is the case in this problem of racism, their problems were magnified. It's happened with almost every racial or ethnic group that has come to our shores. The Irish, for example, in the early days were the butt of jokes, at least as much, if not more, than the Polish are today. And the Irish had as much trouble getting jobs as the blacks have today. You know, the Irish were just as much mistreated and discriminated against when they first came as the blacks are today, maybe more, much more. There's always been some group somewhere that's been discriminated against. Well, the Jews have the questionable honor of being probably the most persecuted of any ethnic group in the world. Wherever they've gone, the persecution has been bitter. Therefore, they have to function with greater care than the others because they're under constant focus, in constant focus. So he says, if you will do good, then you will maybe encourage people who look at you or who are observing you to glorify God instead of to vilify you or speak evil against you. Now, the main thrust here for ourselves, though, might be not in terms of being aliens in our land, but in a certain sense we are foreigners as far as the non-Christian is concerned. We live in a strange land, as a matter of fact, and we are pilgrims and sojourners. The fact that we're here so briefly should help us to keep our perspective as to how we should live. A lot of things simply don't matter that much because we're just here such a brief amount of time. And the only thing to really focus on is your future in heaven. And we were saying at the beginning, those that came in, we were saying that if you lived, if you were moving to San Francisco and you were going to spend only about 2 more weeks in Los Angeles, you'd certainly not spend too much time with the things that pertain to Los Angeles. You see, you'd be getting ready to go to San Francisco and you'd be putting your requests in for services and so forth in San Francisco. Now that's the way Christians ought to look at their life here. And if there are things in which they have been somewhat taken advantage of and so forth, as he will point out later, better just to suffer it than to make an issue out of it because you're only going to be here for a couple of weeks. I think, for example, in that same connection, if I can labor a little bit more, let's say that you're going to be 2 more weeks in Los Angeles and a neighbor moves in who has a dog that is disturbing. So that dog is barking and barking and causing a lot of trouble, or maybe there are some children next door that are causing trouble. Now, the chances are that you're not going to be particularly interested in getting down to City Hall and trying to get some redress of your grievance. You're not going to worry about that neighbor. You can leave him for the new occupants of your house. You're not going to worry about him yourself. Well, there are a lot of things that bug a person on this earth, and Peter is really saying to you, don't make an issue of it because you're only going to be here a short time anyway. Thus, giving attention to ambition. Self-ambition is something that is questionable. That is, I don't mean the legitimate desire for career. I'm talking about focusing on career or ambitions to the point of jeopardizing your relationship to Christ. It would be a most unwise decision for a person to accept a career or to pursue career goals that would take them away from Christ or diminish their time to fellowship with Christ and the believers and so forth. It would be a very bad choice. Peter is making an extremely important point here about the way you live on the earth because it's got to be in the light of the fact that you're soon going to move. Pursuing that again, let's say in terms of this matter of self-ambition, to pursue self-ambition here in this world in the light of the fact that you're going to be with Christ forever, would be very much like spending all of your time in Los Angeles running for president of, or for, say, member of the city council. You're going to move to San Francisco in 2 weeks and you mount a campaign to run for city council. You've got great ambitions as far as Los Angeles is concerned, and you spend lots of money and time. In fact, you spend so much time setting up your campaign for city council in Los Angeles that you miss out on some things you should be doing before going to San Francisco. You see, that is a very good analogy to what people do on this earth. The amount of time you're going to be on this earth in the light of the amount of time you're going to be in eternity, in fact, it'll be timeless because time is going to be no more. There's so little comparison. There's no comparison at all. I mean, this is the rest of the years on the earth, even if you live for another 40 years or 50, as some of you no doubt would, or 60, even if you live 40 or 50 years on this earth, what is that in the light of eternity? It's like a few hours here in Los Angeles in the light of moving to San Francisco for the rest of your life, you see. You really got to keep things in perspective when you look at that. Corrie ten Boom said once that she was talking about the same thing in terms of her experiences in Europe, and she said she had faced the firing squad over there, and she said when you face the firing squad, you lose an awful lot of the extraneous things that clutter your mind. Rich and poor stand there alike with nothing. And she said, in a lot of ways, the concerns of people on this earth are like a person going about adjusting the blinds in the house when the house is on fire. So much of what consumes us on this earth is in that category of stuff that amounts to nothing as far as eternity is concerned, and yet we get ourselves all in a panic over things, and we're in a frenzy trying to make our way in the world. And we give up, we make choices that cause us to set aside things of spiritual value in the place of things of earthly value. Now, of course, you people are all here tonight, but I find in a lot of meetings that there are people who let almost any little thing come up and keep them away from the meeting. Now, of course, it isn't that I need more chairs occupied. That's never been a particular objective or problem to me. But for their sakes, I could wish that they would be more regular. I don't mean you can't miss these any time you want to. This is not the law of the Medes and Persians, and certainly not going to affect your salvation. But the people that consistently, regularly get their hearts drawn toward the Word of God find strength by that means to keep going. But people that let things come in and don't get to the meetings, they have a much more difficult time making it. But it's amazing what little things can keep people away. Now, anybody, if they're just tired or they had a rough time, is certainly welcome to stay home for an evening. I'm not really concerned about that. I'm talking about people that miss quite often. And it's for some silly little thing. There's a program that's coming in that they're not going to be in town again for another year or something like that, and they can't afford to miss that. Or they're just any number of things. Aunt Millie calls at the last minute and says, I'm going to come over and see you, you know, and instead of saying, well, goodbye, Aunt Millie, it was nice to talk to you, but I'll see you next year. Instead of that, we say, well, come on over, Aunt Millie, and then we say, yeah, I'm so sorry Aunt Millie came over and I couldn't come to the meeting because Aunt Millie was there and I just would hate to hurt her feelings. But of course, maybe the Lord has some feelings too, you know. But we let so many little things come in to, we make choices that are unsound because they put earthly interests ahead of the things of God. And we don't really know how much longer we have on this earth, either as individuals or collectively. You might have another week left on this earth, a few days. It isn't to put you under any bondage about it. It is only to help you see a priority structure here, a set of values that is in the right place. Well, these are the kinds of things that Peter is focusing on here, that the things of the earth, even if they be legitimate in many respects, do, on the other hand, constantly wage war against the soul. Going on to verse 13, we'll strike another note here. Be in an orderly relationship to all human institutions. Now, that may sound a little different than your text. What does the King James text say? Do you have that, Steve? Yeah, that's in verse 13.
Ordinance of man for the Lord's sake.
Be subject to every human ordinance. All right. This has to do with human institutions per se, and he goes on to explain that, whether kings as superiors or rulers that might be identified as officers sent by him to punish evildoers and to praise the doers of good. Now, the word here that is translated perhaps be submissive or be subject to simply means to be in an orderly relationship to. this is a divine order. There has got to be order in the state among the citizens, and God must then allow and does allow for human institutions that keep that order. Otherwise, you would have anarchy. So the people that are of a mind to say that because they're Christians, they can kind of thumb their nose at the government, and there are some people like that, people who won't salute the flag and many, many different things. Yet the Scripture says that governments are necessary to punish evildoers. Now, in Romans 13, you have a very specific statement, a number of very specific statements about it, which lead us in the direction of saying that God has given the government the power over human lives in order to keep some semblance of orderliness. Again, you have the same word which translates be subject. King James says, let every soul be subject to higher powers. Reading it directly from the Greek text, we might translate it, let every soul be in an orderly relationship to the superior authorities. For there is not any authority except by God. And the authorities that be, or the ones that are ordered by God. So then he who resists the authority resists the order of God. And they who resist shall bring judgment to themselves. Now what does he really mean by this? He does not mean that he has appointed every ruler individually. In the book of Acts, chapter 2, we are told that they cast lots to determine who should be the new disciple, because, of course, Judas had fallen. And the lot, it says, fell to Matthias. Now, obviously, God had a hand in that kind of thing, but he is not necessarily presiding over the ballot boxes of the United States. And I use the word necessarily because in the last analysis, I can't tell you exactly what God is doing. But the point I'm really making there is mainly that God is not talking here about individual rulers, but it says that the powers that be are ordained of God. That means the idea of authority, the idea of rulership, is ordained of God. And the reason for it is to keep order. And he urges the believers to be subject to them or to be submissive to these powers for the sake of their own well-being. But he goes on to say those that rule are not a fear to the good work, but to the evil. Do you wish not to fear authority? Then do good, and you will have praise from it. For they are, notice this, a minister of God to you for good. But if you do evil, fear, for they do not bear the sword in vain. For they are ministers of God, punishing unto wrath or avenging unto wrath those who do evil. Now, what he's really saying here is that order is necessary in the world, and that God has put in the hands of government a sword. But those who are concerned about capital punishment, read this. God has put in the hands of government a sword. For what reason? To keep the evildoers in line. Not for the good, but for the bad ones. Now, if everybody in the world were a Christian, then we would not need this kind of authority. God is really protecting the world from itself, because that's the only control that there is over the non-Christian. The Christian is controlled by a higher law. The non-Christian has got to be controlled by human organizations or institutions.
Dude, doesn't the Scripture say that Satan has the power over all the kingdoms of the world?
Yes, in a broad sense he has. There is a paradox here that we just have to kind of hold in abeyance. I can't really solve it for you. Basically, there is a certain limit to what God allows Satan to do in interfering with the progress of the process of man on the earth.
Satan still has something to do with it, though, even though Christ is resurrected.
Satan has a lot to do with it. In other words, there is an institution that, for all of its problems, does, on the other hand, exercise some control over evildoers. For example, in Russia, we would not appreciate in any respect their kind of despotism, but nevertheless, murderers in Russia and thieves and others are under control. Any government, even though it is a corrupt government, is going to exercise some control over the population, else there'd be no country. They know that. Now, that doesn't mean they're not corrupt people. When it says that these are ministers of God, don't think in the same terms of a preacher or a pastor of a church. It's minister in the same sense we use the word to apply to government officials, minister of education or minister of defense or whatever, in some country. Prime minister is a term that applies to the one who has authority over all the other ministers. In British government, they use the term minister. We use a different kind of terminology here, and Russia uses the word commissar instead of minister. Commissar of education, commissar of agriculture, and so forth. So the point we're making is that even though these governments are corrupt, they do, within a certain bound, keep some kind of order in the world. And if you had none of these governments existing, you'd have just total anarchy. Well, you'd have what we did under feudalism in the feudal ages, the feudal era, the Middle Ages. There was no real protection except at that time through whatever the church could afford. Villages were ravaged constantly. It'd be like here in California, for example. Now, we don't believe that the government of California or the government of the United States is beyond corruption. There may be, in some respects, some corrupt elements even in the government of California, as pure as the state is. But still, if you were living in the Middle Ages, if we were to transport ourselves back, or if the conditions prevailed here that prevailed in the Middle Ages, you would expect that Santa Barbara or Ventura or San Pedro might be attacked at any time by some marauding bands that would come down like the Vikings did. They came down in their long boats and ravaged the coasts of Europe. They just land on the shore and go in and take a whole village and butcher the inhabitants and take away the children and the women. And it was just a brutal, brutal era. Well, when the governments began to emerge, beginning with the Carolingian dynasty of the 9th century and then moving on up through the other dynasties of Europe, France, Germany, and all the rest of them, every one of them was corrupt, but on the other hand, they brought a certain amount of order to that feudal system. So that's why I say I can't really solve your problem because there is a measure in which these governments seem to function as demon powers of Satan, especially when tax time comes around. But on the other hand, God does seem to hold some kind of reign over them. Now, we'll go on with some even more startling statements here. He says now that these people, the Jews to whom he's writing, he says to them, you are free men, verse 16, but do not use this freedom as a cloak of evil. In other words, in a certain sense, they are above the laws of the land. We are judged by a higher law than the laws of the land, but we are obliged to keep the laws of the land for the sake of order. So he says, don't use your liberty here as a cloak for evil. The direct illustration of this is when Jesus was questioned by the Pharisees about paying taxes. And he said, bring me a coin. And he said, whose image is on the coin? They said, Caesar's. Well, he said, give it to him. It's his. It's all he's got. I've run into individuals here and there that have been hot on the idea of reversing the income tax thing as unconstitutional. It may be, but some Christian people get very hot under the collar about these things, and they resist this matter. But my attitude toward it is, after all, it's their goods anyway. Let them have it, you know. Who printed that money? Well, the U.S. Treasury printed it. It only belongs to us if we want to fight for it, really. So if that's all they've got going for them, let them have it. I don't mean to be foolish about your taxes or anything like that. I try to be nimble about mine, too. But there is a point here where, in principle, you have to calculate things on this basis, that you are making use of certain aspects of government, and it is only fair that you pay for the aspects that you use. You pay your fair share. When you have paid to the government what you regard as a fair share of your profits, then you're at liberty to work out whatever more or less legitimate ways you can to avoid paying an unjust share of taxes. I often think in terms of small business people who have to engage in various kinds of manipulation, let's say, to be kindly about it, to avoid paying an undue amount of tax. That does not seem fair, for example, if a person is in a certain bracket, they have to pay 40% of their profits to the government, whereas other people pay none or pay 5% or 10% or whatever. There are a lot of things that the average person is not shrewd enough to catch, which even the federal government would accept. If you're in a bracket where you can afford high-priced and high-class CPAs to figure your tax for you and to help you work out shelters and so forth, then you would pay less taxes. But being a simple citizen, you may not have that advantage. So there are other ways that you have to kind of balance the thing out. When the tax time rolls around, this is a very difficult problem for Christians who want to be 100% honest. And statements that they have to make, they think that they're going to be charged an unfair amount of tax because they're trying to be 100% honest. Well, what I have to say to them is, it's a relative matter. It's a question of the spirit of the thing. I don't think even the federal government really, and unless you get above a bracket, and I have to say, to be much a realist here, that I think that many people within the federal government are really working toward a welfare state. I don't say this is the government itself. I say that many people within it are working toward a welfare state, and in that respect are doing everything within their power to level out income and to make it more difficult for the very wealthy to survive. They're trying to redistribute the wealth, and so they gouge the wealthy wherever they can, wherever the wealthy are not shrewd enough to slip out of their clutches. But you see, when you take it at a raw tax level, if you're in the 50% bracket, it doesn't make any sense at all for you as a private citizen to have to pay 50% of your earnings while somebody else only pays 10% or 17% or whatever. It's not fair. I have to say that there are people within the government who are working toward a welfare state that would like to level out all the wealth. But as far as the government itself is concerned, as far as the legislature who makes the laws relevant to these things are concerned, they are not. They want people to take as much advantage as possible. And they assume that a person in the 50% bracket will do whatever he can to find ways not to have to legitimately pay 50% of his income, see? All of these things I'm saying to you for this reason. As you relate to the federal government or any branch of the government, keep in mind that there's such a thing as keeping the spirit of the law. Because otherwise, every little sentence that you put down or every figure you put down, you have to ask yourself, well, if I say an approximate figure here, am I really perjuring myself? It's quite a problem in making out a tax report. You see, you say, well, you know, if I don't remember whether it was 954 or 945. Now, if I put the wrong figure, am I perjuring myself? I've signed that report, and I've said these figures are correct. Well, I'm trying to say to you, don't be disturbed by that if your basic attitude and spirit is to follow the law. What you're going to try to do is pay a fair share of the expense of government. So there are a lot of aspects that if you keep too close a track of it, you lose more than the government even wants you to lose. I worked for a while with a businessman who owned a department store, and he was he often decried the fact that his neighboring shop, the man in the shop next door to him, had one story in a 50-foot frontage. I mean, just a small store of sports attire. And this man had four stories, a department store. And I handled the accounts receivable department for him in that store. But anyway, he said, my neighbor over here keeps his records on a grocery bag, and he drives a new car every year, and I try to keep everything meticulously and keep all my books straight, and I can't even make a profit. So there's something to that thing. You maybe scuttle yourself with too meticulous a record. But the point really I'm trying to make is that Christians are the most vulnerable to the problem of what constitutes absolute obedience to the law. And at what point are they perjuring themselves by making statements that may not be verifiable or may not be exactly accurate? And I say to you, it is the spirit of the matter. A person could keep meticulous books and have a couple of different records and be more falsifying the record than a person who keeps very casual books. If you want to get by with a not paying too much tax, be very careful how meticulously you keep your books. Be at peace about it. Just that's the way to figure it. Am I paying a fair share of my taxes, given my income and potential and so forth? All right. Now, remember then, to help you over a difficult problem, another aspect of it is, it is not true that God appoints each government official. I remember a fellow whom I was discussing an election with another year, several decades ago, in fact. And we were talking about the matter of voting. And this fellow said, well, he said, I pray all the time that the Lord help me to make the right choice. I merely said to him, who did you vote for this time? And he told me, and it happened to be the one that didn't get elected. And I said, well, I don't know what went wrong there. You ask the Lord for guidance. Either he wasn't involved in the election at all, or maybe you didn't get the right signals. But that's the conclusion I would come to, is he was not that much involved in the election. Now, verse 15, thus it is the will of God in doing good to silence the ignorance of senseless men. Now, there was a direct reference to these Jews who were being charged with every kind of imaginable crime. And Jesus is, or Peter rather, is saying to them, you're going to have to be on your guard and be especially careful. Verse 17, honor all men, love the brotherhood, the fellowship, fear God, that means reverence God, and honor the king. Now, there's nothing wrong with honoring the king if we take honor in the terms of ascribing worth to him. Today is a day when young people are more than ever disillusioned with authority, especially because of some of the things that have happened in the circles of authority. So you don't really blame them, and a lot of times the parents have not been an example to them as they should. So You do not blame young people today for, or you understand, one understands today their disillusionment with authority. However, that does not give them the right to deny that authority, or any of us. I know adults fall in the same category, but you notice this especially at, say, at the high school level where, and college level, where young people are constantly resisting the authorities. Now, you have to realize that there's no way that the government can allow its citizens to obey only the laws they agree with. But that is the attitude today among many people. If we don't agree with it, we're not going to obey it. Well, you can't do that. You've got to obey all the laws, because you then would have chaos. And obviously, human beings are not capable of making totally equitable laws. But we must respect authority. I have young people who have parents that are not really the kind of parents you would think that they could respect as persons. After all, if a young person has a father who's an alcoholic, and they only see him drunk all the time, you'd hardly expect them to respect him in the sense we think of respect. However, that does not excuse that young person from being under the authority of that father. They may not respect him in the sense of feeling that he was a very worthwhile person, but they must respect the fact that he is, as a matter of fact, the authority in that home. It's unfortunate. They may not like the things he does, but still he is an authority. And the Lord says that the young people ought to, I mean the people in general ought to respect authority. Now, also love the fellowship, he says, the brotherhood of believers, the word love there meaning merely to be considerate and careful of them. And then you householders or stewards, that would be people, a man who was in charge of certain aspects of a given household would be called a householder or a steward. You stewards, be in an orderly submission with all fear to the despots, the masters. The actual Greek word here means despots. Now, here's the startling statement. Not only to the good and gracious, but also to the, well, the word is really perverse, perverted, or crooked, the rascals, the scallywags. Let's say that you have a boss. Well, let's go back to a point of slavery, because now you have a choice. If you have a boss that you feel is dishonest, you probably would not want to go on working for him. But let's say you were a slave in Paul's time. Now, this poses real ethical problems. Here's a Christian who's a slave, and they've got a master that is crooked. Now, I don't think that they would be obliged by God to steal for the master, but they might be obliged to take orders from someone whom they despised as being crooked. That's a very important point, because it affects even households, for example. Should children be subject to non-Christian parents? Well, according to the Scripture, they should, and while they're children. Now, I don't go along with the, nor does the Bible, with some current thought that as long as a person is single, they're subject to their parents. One such person is still middle age and still being subject to his parents, and that's going a little far. But one is not obliged to be subject to their parents all their life, but as their children, as long as they're children in the home, and I think we could strike an arbitrary figure here of saying that when a young person reaches 18, in the sight of the law, they're on their own, although I think possibly a few more years under the tyrannical roof of their parents might not be too bad, especially since all the bills may be paid for them. But as long as a person is a child in the home, under the care of the parents and being supported by them, then they are subject to the laws of the home. And there's a good rule of thumb. If a young person does not want to be subject to the laws of the home, then they should not be supported by the home. And if they are, then they should be more submissive to the rules of the household. If you're paying room and board, you're like a star boarder. You have certain privileges of independence, but if the parents are supporting you, then you may have to be submissive to them. But generally speaking, he's talking about children and slaves here, and he says the slave must be subject to its master. Very interesting point is that Jesus never went about trying to stem the tide of slavery in the world. He more or less accepted it as one of the realities of life. Now we're going to hit the reasoning for this. He says, for this is, the English text says thankworthy, but this is grace. This is an illustration of grace if for the sake of conscience, or the conscience of God, one bears the affliction of suffering unjustly. For what sort of credit is it if, while sinning and being beaten, one endures it? But if while doing good and suffering one endures, this is gracious with God, thankworthy, creditable. In other words, of course, he's saying here that if you are punished for doing good, for doing evil, you're getting your just reward. If you're punished for doing good and you bear it, then it shows that the grace of God is with you.